Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 29th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Reverence for Community, Jihad, presented by Nellie von Dornharder.
We have also born again Muslims. Exactly the same mechanism. Born again. What else?
They take their scripture literally.
They take the scripture literally, but do they take everything literally?
No.
Not really. They have to pick and choose, right? They have to pick and choose. So, what else?
They don't take reason or scientific research or anything.
They want to ignore, if possible, reason and scientific research. What about philosophy? Do they accept philosophy?
It's not a sure thing.
It's not sure, right? And it gives you a headache. You have to think too hard, right? You have to think too hard, yeah?
Well, they cluster together and listen only to each other. They are not open to and brainwashed.
Whoa. Now, let's see. Remind me if I forget one. They're very sure. They are almost... Can we almost call it a sect? Mm-hmm. Sect-like?
How about
exclusive?
Insular. That's nice. Thank you. Now, the problem is I never know where that thing is, but so we write insular. And they take the Bible literal, but on the other hand, they don't really take it serious in all aspects. And which am I forgetting now?
They fear modernity.
Oh, modernity, yeah. They say the world, right? They fear it, but they also use it. But have you met a very extremist right-wing young person? Hey, here, just play, lots of place here. Come, if you want to join us. Yeah. Sorry, I just thought that everybody else was leaving on the bus.
Typical Lutherans, they fill up the back for...
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
They don't take reason or scientific
intervention. That was it. Yeah, they're just science. Well, in the sense of science, a lot of them are engineers, right? So how shall we say that? Not too much philosophy. Not too much. It is. You want to be sure again. You don't want to be. So it's kind of as opposed to philosophical reasoning and thinking. The question was, what are the similarities between a far right young Christian and a Muslim extremist? That was the question. And we have all the points. We have all the points. Because when we talk about extremism in Islam, it has a lot of similarities with extremism in other religions. You know, reading the mind of God, being sure about what God thinks, that is basically the hallmark. But indeed, it is a reaction. It is a reaction, we can say, against the world, against modernity. It can be a reaction against having the idea that your civilization or your religion is in decline. Like, remember we talked about the Wahhabis? Everybody knows the Wahhabis now? Do you know the Wahhabis? No? What is your name? What are your names?
Kristen
M?
Madeline.
You've never heard about Wahhabis? Well, that was a guy in the 18th century, more or less, in Saudi Arabia, who said, oh my gosh, our society is on the brink of falling apart. Nobody is a good Muslim any longer. Everybody is like chanting mystical songs, going to the graves of saints. That is not true Islam. We have to purify. So that is what they want to do, purify. Purify. So the world really means purification. And that is why the biggest enemies of extremists is not us. It is other Muslims. Those are worse enemies than us, Christians.
To them.
Other Muslims who want to bring in philosophy and, God forbid, tradition of thinkers, and who want to show that Islam can be diverse, and also culture. They don't like culture at all. Culture is scary. Think the Taliban. Remember the Taliban? You remember the Taliban? Afghanistan? Those guys with those hats on their, what do you call it? Towels on their head and things like that. And long robes. Well, what was the first thing the Taliban did when they gained power?
They forbade kite flying. Very dangerous sport, kite flying. What is dangerous about kite flying? Well, kite flying, if the kite gets in the tree and you climb up the tree, you might happen to look into a garden where a woman is walking around unveiled. Very dangerous. Yes. They forbade bird singing contests. Do you know bird singing contests? You have seen them? Are they here too? In Asia, you have everywhere bird singing contests. You raise, birds are put in a cage very high, and the higher you put them, the more they sing. And then they sing against each other. Why were the bird singing contests forbidden? Well, they could interfere with the call to prayer. That was so scary, right? So they felt, you know, that the whole idea is the culture should not interfere with the pure Islam. Now, is there a pure Christianity or a pure Islam? No. No, and that's what we always have to remember. It's basically all in the head. It's all in the mind. It's a dream. It's an ideal that does nowhere. It does not exist. But why has it exploded in our days? Because we now have Muslims moving all over the world. We have Muslims in America. We have Muslims in Europe. In the south of Russia, we have all these Muslim societies. There's a chair here if you want to sit. Yeah, it's sorry, I didn't see you. Did you want to use it?
Fine.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine.
Okay, I didn't realize that. But you can use the technique. Yeah. There we go.
There you go.
Oh,
sorry. Yeah.
Huh? Oh, there's another chair here. If you want to sit. Yeah? Anyway, where were we? So, you know, south of Russia, that was, you know, communist, right? Now you have Dagestan, Tajikistan, Chechnya. They're all free. And those are Muslim countries originally. So you have all of a sudden all these countries with opportunities. Former Yugoslavia, opportunities for Islam to reinvent itself. Or I should say for Muslims. It's not Islam that reinvents itself. Muslims reinvent themselves. So the whole thing is the world, right? You go here, you come here, and there is this scary world filled with Americans who have, churches and a Christian society and who have cheesecakes and church meetings and so forth
television.
And so forth. What?
Television and movies.
And they have television, but the television movies you have also outside America. That's the thing. So there is all of a sudden this whole society and you have to come to terms with that society. So if we talk now about, let's say, extremism and fundamentalism, we have to much more see it as a reaction against the West, Western society, and a reaction against new conditions. What can you leave and what do you accept? You see? New conditions. In each of these former Russian countries, Muslims have to reconsider their state of being. Now, who helps them reconsidering? Saudi Arabia. So now I'm going to write my three. Was any of you, were you here this morning?
Yeah.
I thought so. Yeah.
I learned slowly.
What? Okay. I hope I'm not boring you.
Okay.
Because now here is my famous three, four. Oh, thank you. Now this pen has stopped writing right now. Let's use green. That's the color of Islam anyway. So Palestine. Saudi Arabia, you say Saudi, right?
Saudi.
Okay, and then we have what I call Indonesia, Nigeria, and I'll come back to that. And going through that are all kinds of individual groups. Al-Qaeda basically is an individual group. It is not based in one country. It does not depend, it happens to depend on bin Laden, but not only on bin Laden. It is really international. So if we now think about suicide bombers, because that is what's most on our mind, right? We already said it's a small minority. And we have three types. The first one is Palestine.
Palestinian suicide bombers, the first Muslim suicide bombers, I don't know if you are aware of that, started in 83, and I'll tell you how it started. Now, Palestine is considered as okay. Suicide bombers in Palestine are okay, because remember how through the Quran and the tradition and the history, Jews are really non-humans to a Muslim. Jews are really, well, the only faith that they deserve according to a real, solid, not open-minded Muslim is death. But have you picked up on whatever, you know? So, okay, blowing up Jews is just fine. And also you want Israel back anyway. So until Israel is gone, suicide bombing in Palestine, a lot of interpreters of the Quran feel it's allowed. Because it is the real jihad. And I'll tell you what the real jihad is. We'll come back to that. Can you read this?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay. The real jihad. But then we have a lot of other types of suicide bombings. And then we come, for example, to what has happened in England. Where does that come from? Well, that comes from a combination of things. The model comes from Palestine, how to do it, right? And what kind of material to use and what kind of car blows best and things like that. I don't know, explodes best. And then you have again Saudi Arabia. And someone asked this morning, remember, how can this be? And what we said, because they found a pot of gold. That is the whole answer. They have so much money, and they are a place where the two holy places of Islam are Mecca and Medina, where the Prophet lived and where he built his community, Prophet Muhammad. So they are really the ones who are spreading into the world their vision of Islam. Doesn't necessarily say go blow yourself up, but it always says that Islam should be superior. It always should say that Muslims should defend themselves. Now keep it in your head the word defend, because that's what jihad comes down to, defend. So that is Saudi Arabia. And if you look, and I will send this around in this book. This is a marvelous book. If any of you wants to read more about it, because as you know by now, after 50 minutes, realize we have not one package or one model that we are talking about. We have different strains, different developments within Islam. And some are anti-modern, some are reactions to internal developments. A lot are searches for power, money and power. If you have the Islamic society and you are the boss, you have the money and the power, right? So you have, and I come back to that too. So you have, it's not just one model that you say, this creates suicide bombers, or this creates fundamentalists. But what we are now at is at a new stage, and I kept telling you, there is a battle going on in the Muslim world. A battle about how to interpret Islam. What should Islam be? And so what we are seeing, when we see these extremist attacks, then we're just seeing the top of an iceberg. This battle is mainly going on between Muslims. You know, it happens to happen in the West now too, because Muslims are living in the West and they're coming to terms with the West. Right? Do I make myself clear? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if anybody is interested, I'll pass the book around if you want the title. Olivier Roy, he is a French sociologist, and he used to be a high school teacher. Very useful to be a high school teacher. He used to have students who later on became very extremist. Yeah, he taught in a place where there were lots of Muslims, and that is how he could keep his ear on the ground, and he's an incredible, brilliant writer and brilliant scholar. So he made that book. It's very, very informative if you read it. So we see three strains of how people can become violent. The first one, Palestine, that's clear, right? The second one, fed by material produced in Saudi Arabia that is extremely extremist and conservative and really preaches that Islam should reign, and then someone interprets for him or herself, oh, then I should go and blow some people up who are in my way, right? Or
I should blow something up to give a sign that I stand for a certain message, or that I have power and they don't. So that is another issue. And then you have these situations in countries like Indonesia and Nigeria, because this battle for the souls of Muslims is going on, especially around what you would call the fringes. Former Yugoslavia, former Russia, Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, and of course, the whole Africa. The whole of Africa is a battleground, because in a lot of African countries, there are large Christian majorities, or it's half-half, like Nigeria is half-half. And at the same time, in Africa, you still have a lot of people practicing tribal religions. Or they are Muslim or Christian, and they still practice tribal religions. So this battle goes on not in the Middle East. It comes from the Middle East, but it goes on outside the Middle East. And then in a place like Indonesia, and I'll tell you more about that in a minute, in a place like Indonesia, the military who is seeking power takes up Islam as a chip in their game and wants to use Islam to assert their own position of power. Do I make sense?
Yes.
Yeah? And I'll come back to that and I'll explain it. So if you look at the different conflicts that are going on in the world, they have different origins. But it all goes back to the interpretation of jihad. Jihad is what? Jihad is defending the faith. Do you have a question?
I do.
Yeah.
I mean, you may have covered this in the first class I've taught. In Sudan, in Darfur, isn't there also race involved, Arabs versus Africans?
Yes. Yes.
And if I remember, they're both Muslims.
And the Arab Muslims are purer than the African Muslims. And that's why they kill the African Muslims. Because as you say, within the Muslim communities, the battle is much, much fiercer than what comes to us. Yeah, but that is, it's good you know that. Very few people realize that it is a Muslim conflict, what's happening in Darfur.
But is it a race conflict as opposed to, is religion taken out of it?
Well,
we enslaved slaves and we turned into Christians, and we still didn't treat them very well as Christians. You know, I don't even think religion was part of it. It was a completely folded race.
Right. Well, there is a race card too, because this is terrible to say, but when I lived in Egypt, I discovered that black people also discriminate among each other, and the blackest of the blackest are called green. Green, yeah. And if you call someone green, it means that you really look down on them. And then you look at the people who call someone green and you think, I don't see any difference between this person. But they do. And that to me was a big shock. It was a big shock to realize that. So I haven't seen pictures, but maybe the Arab background attackers, because they are the ones who attack, are a shade lighter. I don't know. But it could well be. Yeah.
In these three parts of the world we're talking about, how is Saudi Arabia then viewed by the rest of the Muslim world? Is it despised or is it admired? People look to Saudi Arabia to be leaders in Islam?
Yeah. That's a very good question. There's an extremely dualistic attitude. People cannot criticize it openly because it is the guardian of the two holy shrines of Islam. So they feel it's very inappropriate to say anything negative about Saudi Arabia. On the other hand, Saudis are despised. Saudis, when they move around, I'm sorry to say, they don't always behave very correctly. In the summer in Egypt, the Saudis will come because it's too hot. I mean, Egypt, it's a harbor only. But Saudi Arabia is hotter. So they come and spend the summer in Egypt, and you have to hide your daughters. You have to hide them because they're in constant danger. I know that because, they would congregate in the Hilton, you could not go to the Hilton and buy a stamp without being arrested. And so Saudis are despised. Yeah. The people who come. So there is, as I said, there's this dual attitude. Plus, what people also very much resent is that they want to import the Middle Eastern culture. They say, we have our own culture. But again, you know, this kind of mindset doesn't like culture. But which culture? Because nobody lives in a vacuum. You always have some culture. So what culture is it? The culture of the Prophet. And what culture is the Prophet's culture? From where is that? Do you know it? Saudi Arabia, because that's where he was born and raised. So that's why you see, you know, very, very legalistic Muslims wear a white dress and either a turban on their head or a skull cap, because that was what the Prophet was wearing, right? You had another question?
Okay, now how do the Persians
oh, good question. Yeah, well, thank God they don't really.
Okay.
Thank God, I said this morning, right? Thank God that the Sunnites and the Shiites are at odds. And in sermons, you have this hierarchy of who stinks, okay? This hierarchy of who's really bad. The West, a Christian, or Jews first, of course. But the worst for Sunnites are Shiites, worse than pigs. I've read that in sermons. The worst for Shiites are Sunnites, worse than pigs or dogs, even worse. So, and in a way, I feel that is a blessing for us. Because if that would unite, you know, then God knows what we would get then. The front would get bigger and stronger. So they have their own story. They have their own story of violence. But in a way, you know, it has a little bit of a different flavor, but you will not have a Shiite joining a Sunnite group and blow him or herself up. If you want to be a proper Shiite, you blow yourself up in Shiite Islam, right? So, and then again, what you have, most emigrants from Iran, most Shiites who are here, were refugees. So that is, again, that's a different type of people who came here. And then they are a minority, in the minority. I have Shiite students, they will never say openly they're Shiite. They won't say it openly. They don't dare to say it openly when there are Sunnites around. So there you have a little bit of a different development going on. Thanks for your question, the great question. Where were we? Jihad. Let's now first go back to basics, jihad. Do you want to sit somewhere? Are you okay? It seems so tiring to stand. Sorry. Jihad is defending your community. That is what jihad is for. Jahada, which is the root, means to exert yourself for God. To strain, to do strenuous work for God. That is what it means. What it means to do strenuous work for God? To defend. In the Quran, whom did you defend your community against? The people from Mecca who stayed polytheist and kept attacking the Muslims after they moved to Medina. Remember, they moved from Mecca to Medina because they had to flee. And in Medina, the people from Mecca kept attacking them. And then it's only then jihad comes, only in the Quran in the last 10 years of the Prophet's life. It is defending your community for God. Because if you do not defend your community, it will die out. That is the bottom line. And as the empire spread and Islam became the main power, jihad was no longer really necessary. So it changed the meaning into protecting your community, as in you yourself individually do all your duties. You do your prayers, you do your fasting, you believe that there's one God, the five pillars. That is what you do, your personal jihad. Then you teach your children, that is your other personal jihad. You make sure your family doesn't fall apart. That is your other jihad. And you make sure that nobody in the village or in your community falls off the faith. Falls away from the faith. Hence, someone who converts within Islam, according to the rules and law, has to be killed. And it happens. It happens. You will be killed. If you are in Egypt and you are a Muslim and you say, in my heart I saw Jesus, I now am a Christian, you will be killed, and so will the priest of the church you go to, and if he has happened to baptize you, he will be killed, and his family will be killed, and the deacons and the deaconesses will be killed, and the church probably will be closed, because that church brought this person into temptation. So see, that is what jihad was until the 20th century. Until the 20th century, that was what jihad was. It was you defend your community and you defend yourself, and you are a good Muslim. So it was also, often when you speak with Muslims, they say jihad is really spiritual. It is not fighting, it's not war. It's the spiritual warfare, you against your vices. And again, we all have vices, whether you're Muslim, Buddhist, everybody has vices, don't worry about that. So you see, that is what you fight against. Until the 20th century, there was a person called Said Qutb. Has anybody heard about him? Who has heard about Mr. Qutb? Nobody has heard about Mr. Qutb? Said Qutb? Who was Mr. Qutb? Mr. Qutb was a Muslim brother. The Muslim Brothers was a group in Egypt who started in the 1920s, and they felt that Islam should really be renewed and revived, especially among the poor people. So they built clinics, and they had all kinds of social programs, and they actually did a lot of good work. And they were fine until they started to attack the government and say, you are not Muslims ruling over us, and we should rule instead. And then the government started to close them down and put them in jail. And Said Qutb was from that group. And he was... I think he was executed in 61. He was executed by Nasser, by the Nasser government. Why was he executed? Because he also, you know, wrote that Muslims of the Brotherhood should become the leaders of a Muslim state. Where did he get his main ideas? This is very interesting. You remember. Where did he get his main ideas?
Do I remember?
In a church basement in America. That is what happened. Was this? He was a teacher. He was a high school teacher, and then he became an employee in the government in the ministry. And he was sent to America to study an education. And there were not that many Muslims in America in the 40s, 50s. This must have been somewhere 40s, 50s. But there were some very kind-hearted pastors who invited him over to his church, to their church. And what he saw there, oh my God, end of civilization. This country's gonna collapse any minute. He knew it for sure. People dancing, mixed men and women together, unmarried. And the pastor himself turned down the lights. And he has written it down. You can read it. But this made him think. This made him think. He saw America. He saw this ocean of Christians. And this made him think about the position of Islam. So he went back to Egypt, where he felt that the government were heathens, pagans, were not truly Muslims, where most other Muslims were not truly Muslims. And who had influenced them? The Christians from the West. They were studying, you know, Christian philosophy. They were studying Western books, technical books, you know, to become an engineer. Most books came from the West. So what Said Qutb started to think is, where do these Christians belong in our view of the world? Now, who remembers what the Quran says where Christians belong? Does the Quran say Christians have to be killed?
No.
Stay away. What? You stay away from them, but you have to accept them. The Quran says that Christians and Jews are people of the book. You have to accept them, whether you like it or not. You stay away from them to keep yourself pure, but you have to accept them. You do not need to kill them. And remember the dhimmis, that they have this special status where they are no longer allowed to build churches and they're no longer allowed to have mission activities, and we said that's actually a death sentence for any community. Remember that? Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Said Qutb got a new idea.
He divided the world in two. One was believers, and the other ones were non-believers. And of course, the first non-believer was the president of Egypt, and that's what landed him in jail. And then there were lots of Egyptian non-believers. You remember, he was an Egyptian. And then there were Christians, and they were non-believers too. So all of a sudden, because he made the division of the world in two, and he said, we should revive jihad against the non-believers. And that was the first time that jihad was expressed again in terms of aggression, armed aggression. Nobody did it yet, because it took a while for his ideas to take hold of the community. But does anybody remember that in the 70s and 80s, lots of Christians were attacked in Egypt?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember? That happened. Lots of Christians, churches. His ideas had gotten hold of some population elements, some elements of the population. And so they started to attack the Christians. Because what they did, they started to attack with those who were close by. You know, 70s, 80s, people didn't travel that much yet. There was not that many Muslims who migrated to the West yet. So it was local. And so you look around the Muslim world and you see these local incidents. You see them in Syria. You see them in Lebanon. You see them, of course, in Palestine. It was against Christians and against Jews. And that is then where you then also see Hamas starting to realize, aha, Palestine, how do we liberate it? The Jews are here too, of course. This is not just Christians, this is Jews as well. And so it took them a while, but by 1983 they had the first suicide bomb ready. So you see, it was this man, this Sayyid, who redefined the interpretation of Islam, and as we say, you pick and choose, because is this in the Quran? No, it is not. This is not in the Quran. In the Quran it says that you have to accept Christians and you should not murder them unless they attack you, unless they bring you in danger. And so, according to Sayyid Qutb, after seeing the dancing in the basement, the whole Muslim world was now in danger. Right? Because what if they export the twist and the foxtrot? Right? So, that will be the beginning of the end of our civilization. That was, you see how the thinking went? Any questions so far? Can we follow me? Yeah? Can we all follow? Yeah?
Well, the antagonism towards the Jews, because they were also supposed to tolerate the Jews in the Quran.
Yeah, but the Jews, the problem is that they retook Israel. They retook land that was claimed by Muslims. Never mind, there were lots of Christians. Right? Christian palaces. They retook the land that was claimed by Muslims, and that is a big sore wound. Think Spain. You all know that the Muslims were in Spain till Christopher Columbus discovered America. That was the year that the last Muslim was kicked out or had to convert to Christianity. Right? That is, Spain keeps coming up. If you listen to Bin Laden, have you heard him mention Spain? If you listen carefully, you'll hear it. He mentioned Spain, because that is also a sore wound. It was gone. Yeah?
Of course, nobody said this yet, but the Jews that went to Israel were the extremists.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you say they were the
Zionists?
The real.
Yeah. Yeah, the Zionists. And
still are in charge.
In the beginning, many rabbis were against it. Yeah. So it's very complicated history. The Jewish. The Zionist history, that makes me dizzy, really. That is so complicated.
It's on all three religions.
Yeah. But you know, from the Arab point of view, this should not have happened. And you know that they have tried to attack Israel many times and failed. And that is a sore wound as well. Oh my God, the 67 war and the 76 war, and both times they lost. Terrible. They just can't get over it. Really, you shouldn't mention it. They can't get over it. Especially not when they live in the Middle East, you know. But how could this happen? There were so many more people. Okay, so that is what happened. That ideology. Now, in Saudi Arabia, you have interpreters of the Quran. Do they all agree with Sayyid Qutb? No, because some are very, very specifically reading the Quran and saying, no, this is not in the Quran. But they did not condemn him. You see? And they are very,
very conservative into, again, Islam should reign, Islam should rule, Muslims should always have the upper hand, Muslims should, if that's a Muslim, should keep themselves pure, blah, 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 blah. So what you get is, on top of Said Qutb's idea, you get other ideas which come from Saudi Arabia. For example, the mixed marriage. You all know that according to Islamic rule, a Muslim woman cannot marry a non-Muslim man, because the man is the head of the family and will raise the kids into the faith, so that cannot be a non-Muslim. But a Muslim man can marry a non-Muslim Christian or Jewish woman. He can, that's allowed. Because he will be the head of the family and the children will automatically be born in the Muslim faith. However, the Saudi interpreters of the Quran, the sheikhs, they get worried. What if a Muslim is in America and marries a nice Lutheran girl and in secret she takes those kids to church? Right? That can happen. So now they have come up and they say, no, mixed marriage, no more, forbidden. Marriage with a non-Muslim, forbidden. Don't do it. Or they don't forbid it. What they say is, it is extremely despicable to do it, and you don't do extremely despicable act as a Muslim. You can't do it. That is the same as, you know, it's forbidden. So you see, slowly the interpretation goes away from even the Islamic law, because in the Islamic law you can marry someone. As a man, you can marry a Muslim, a non-Muslim woman, a Christian or a Jew. Does it make sense? So you see, there is waffling going on. Now, where does the waffling go? It is translated into English, and it goes on the internet. And there we have the big issue of our time. The net, through the net, everybody becomes his or her own theologian. And also, I've said this before, individualism. Individualism reigns both in the Muslim world and here. And especially Muslims who come here, whether they want it or not, they become individualistic, right? So they now have to choose themselves. How can I be a Muslim? And what do I dress? And that's why you have such a big range of Muslims that you know, some are totally modernized, some are semi-secular, and some are very, very much insular, right? So the whole issue comes down to your own interpretation. You become your theologian. You look at the net, you ask questions, and you see what the Saudi sheikh said. Because if you look at the net, this is very interesting, and Allah writes it too, it's a handful of people that you can name who are behind the websites. A handful is behind the websites, and their stuff gets translated. And it is not the progressive stuff that gets translated. It's not the moderate stuff that gets translated. It's their stuff that gets, and it's pushed all over the world. Yeah.
How about Arab news sources like Al Jazeera, things like that?
Well, they are not so much a source for religion.
Ah.
They are a source for ethics and things. They are, although they are important too, in the sense that if you watch Al Jazeera, They will discuss at great length, you know, how a family can live in the West. So in a way, they are part of this, and then they invite, of course, certain sheikhs. But not everybody watches Al Jazeera. So the net really is there for everybody, right? And so now you think about the young bombers in London, okay? I see your hand. Can I just finish my sentence? The young bombers in London, they read the net, they become inspired, they feel, of course, a little bit on the fringe of society. Because that is, again, we cannot say it is people who are poor, or it is people who can't find jobs, or it is people who are not accepted. It depends where they are, how their social condition is. England, maybe they are on the fringes of the society, but not necessarily so. But the main idea is, how do I defend my faith? How do I stay pure in this community? So they read the net, and they maybe come under the influence of some very radical thinkers. Then they go to a mosque that has people who preach the same kind of message, and there they somehow fall into, now we have to use the C word, a cult. They fall into a cult-like existence.
And they are fed, and then, you know, the bombers are chosen. They're handpicked. They're handpicked by the leaders of mosques. And as you know now, I don't know if you read the news about London, that they now also practice hiding your identity. So they have become very, very, fundamentalist, literalist, whatever word you want to use, Muslims. But they hide that identity. And remember the one who always watched cricket? Did you see that? That his uncle said, I don't know, he's always watching cricket. Cricket is his great passion. You know, so you, with the Shaykh in the mosque, he had decided, what can my cover be? Cricket. You see, they have a cover. And I remember Mohammed Atta and his friends who were drinking whiskey before going on the plane and hiring prostitutes to hide. I'm not sure if it was just for hiding. I don't know. Maybe they're drinking some courage and think, oh, we'll be purified anyway. Never mind. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I cannot look in their minds. But you see, it's very complicated. But it looks like a cult. And if you look at these extremist groups that blow up other people, they are really. They look much more like the extremist groups we have had to deal with, like the Baader-Meinhof in Germany, in the 70s, 80s? 70s more, right? What did we have here? The SDS? People said?
Oh, SLA.
SLA? I don't know them.
Sudanese Liberation Army.
Yeah. You said we, it's like these groups who have a certain goal, and then, you know, to reach the goal, blow up society, wanna blow up society, and then I'll let you ask your question, because now I have to say one thing. It's all in the mind. And I'll come back to that. Because, as I said before, if we all become Muslims, we phone Bin Laden and say, Bin Laden, guess what? We were in Holden and we decided we all convert to Islam. Mm-hmm. What a headache would we be to him? Why would we be a headache? Huh? We don't think like him. We will be obstinate, cynical, questioning, you know, questioning his authority, right? We would still be Lutherans and behave as Lutherans. Think the whole world would become awesome. Then what? How would that be? They would go nuts, right? Or if there were Hindu Muslims, think about it, with all their gods and goddesses, but all one in the end, you know. They couldn't cope, but it's so it is very ideological. There is no real plan. Yeah, your question.
I would go back to your talking about the net, and the net is really very recent historically.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that you have to have a certain level of economic wherewithal to have access to the net.
Right.
But
that's why I say it's not just the net, but it is different developments. It is these different developments. Palestine, Saudi pamphlets that are spread all over the world, and Saudi missionaries that go out all over the world. And now the last development is the net. You see? And it's the net that catches, the internet that catches lots of young Muslims in the West.
And it's not as expensive as it used to be. Mm-hmm. And go to a library.
Mm-hmm.
And
most people have access.
And you can now find it, you know, because that is also, in the other class someone asked, individualism, you know, the individual chooses. What about countries where it's not that individualistic? Well, these developments are going so fast, you won't believe. Because I gave the example. I left Cairo in December 1990. And then I came back a few times, and then I didn't go for several years, and I came back, I think it was 97. And suddenly, on every room, on every roof, like mushrooms, were dishes, satellite dishes.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never been there before. And so now, the whole world comes into everybody's living room, and they cannot control it. It is there. You can see the BBC news. You can see everything. You see? So also in the Middle East, and in only in the poorest countries, it is not like this yet, but in many countries, these
these developments go very fast, and basically, think about it, you only need one dish per village. And you can change a whole culture and a whole mindset. So again, that is also the internal struggle within Islam. And that is why the worst enemy of fundamentalists, I hate that word, but let's say it, is other Muslims and modernity. Although they use modernity. They use it. Without modernity, they could not exist. Okay, other questions? Before we go on to Indonesia, I want to give you a little bit of an insight how these struggles work on the ground, how they do this. Any questions right now? Yeah?
I was just wondering, this is maybe a little off the track, but you talked about the Sunnis and the Shiites. What is your feeling of the Iraq government when you have such between these two groups? Can they ever come together?
Well, if they stress nationality and not religion. If they say we want, like we did in the United States of America, we want a national project, we want to become a nation, then they can do it. It will be hard though. It will not be easy.
How do you force create a nation out of tribes?
You can't. They will fight for a while till they wake up and think, you know. Like we did in Europe after the Reformation. We were fighting so much that one day someone woke up and thought, if we keep fighting, we'll all be dead. Uh-huh. So we better have some kind of a peace, right? And that's where we had the first type of peace agreement, which later led to the universal human rights. Because we have those, not because we loved each other so much, you know, but because we hated each other so much. And we think that we have to stop. We have to stop. And that if that comes, then they will. Or you need a dictator again. Because that's what happens in those countries. A dictator will just shut them all down and say, now we're all Iraqi or Indonesian, because that's what happened in Indonesia. And then they have to follow the program. Tito, Yugoslavia, you see? Yeah. There was a hand there and a hand there. Did I see a hand there somewhere? Or was it someone scratching? Yeah? No? Okay. Then you?
I was wondering your opinion on how much this is a battle of religious purity with Islam versus cultural power.
Yeah.
I think when you mentioned it, Osama, he made a comment about 80 years ago, he was talking about the reason for 9/11. And that was, I guess, the end of the last caliph.
Yeah, that is the caliphate.
The culture.
Yeah, that is look. Because of the net, and because Muslims are now everywhere, the dream of one pure Islam that is divorced from culture has become possible. At least people think it has become possible. You see what I mean? Now you can be just a Muslim and be practicing and take the Quran literal and do all the Muslim, you know. That is what he wants, really. Divorce everything from culture and destroy the culture. And of course, then the American culture should be destroyed first of all, right? But like we said earlier, it is all in the mind, because there's no follow-up plan. There is no follow-up plan. The big example is 81, when Sadat was killed. Sadat, remember, President Sadat was murdered in 1981. And he was watching a parade, a military parade, and suddenly officers jumped out and turned out to be Muslim extremists and shot him and everybody else standing next to him. Right? Do you remember that? Yeah. Or if you don't, you know it now. What happened was that a day later, there were pamphlets on the streets which were the testament of the brain behind the attack. And it was called the Forgotten Duty. The forgotten duty was jihad. That's our duty. We had to start the forgotten duty again. And if you read it, what he actually thought would happen was this. We kill Sadat. He is just a symbol of evil. He has made peace with Israel. Remember, he made peace with Israel. He drinks champagne in public. He is so evil. The moment he drops down, heaven will somehow open. And he seriously writes it. Heaven will somehow open. And maybe God, the prophet, I don't know who, will come to earth and set everything straight. And all the Muslims in the world will raise up, and shells will fall from their eyes, and they will all become good Muslims. Of course, it didn't happen. But in many ways, that was what Bin Laden thought too.
Sounds like Bush's expectation in Iraq.
I'm not going to. Let's not go into that. but in a way, Bin Laden. Did you hear him talk after 9/11 on these tapes that over 100 people in the Netherlands converted spontaneously to Islam? Ha ha. I happen to be from there. Ha ha. That was, you know, what a nonsense. He just thought that, you know, somehow everybody in the world would see the light and say, oh, it's Bin Laden, he's so great and so true what he says. We have to follow him. It didn't happen. So you see, Roy calls them a pre-Leninist. They call pre-Leninist, because before Lenin, you know, they also thought that if the people stand up and start to move, then there will be a revolution of the people and everything will be fine. Well, it never was fine, you see? So in a way, it is very unrealistic, ideological. And as I say, if we write from home that we all became Muslims, it would just give them a big headache, but they don't realize that. And so it is, there is no real plan for the future. And that is why it looks more like SLA, keep forgetting,
SLA,
or Baden-Meinhof, then that it really looks like a planned movement for conversion, or because those planned movements for conversion come from Saudi Arabia. Okay, can you follow me? So we have these different strains. Now I want to go to Indonesia, and in Nigeria, things, very similar things happen, and what I want to read to you is about Indonesia. What happened there is, first of all, we had Suharto. Suharto was the general, and he ruled Indonesia with a real iron fist. And from 66 till 98. And in 98, he was forced out. And so he very much relied on the military. The military had a very important place in his scheme of work, right? So the military felt very, very threatened when he was disposed of, or what do you call it, when deposed. Now you had Suharto forbade extremist Islamic thoughts, but all the time you did have a lot of literature from Saudi Arabia coming in, all the time, in all kinds of journals and little booklets. And you could get those for free. They were sent to you for free. All you needed was hand in a name and you got them. Or they would drive, you know, the people distributing them would drive to the most remote rural place and bring them there. So there was this Saudi strain of extremist thinking being totally ticked off by Indonesia, which had this model where they accepted Hindus, Buddhists, Christians, together with Muslims, and there was a lot of cultural rituals that you know, make sure that people were at peace and so forth and so forth. So that was already happening during this Suharto regime, but you could not openly be an extremist. The moment the guy goes, the democratic era has started, they said. You, like, I don't know, how can I say it? Like locusts flying in, suddenly, everywhere, were extremist-minded young people. They had been trained in Quran schools in secret, and they suddenly came out. I see them in my mind driving into the city where I live on trucks. They were on the back of trucks, and then they would go up and start to preach and start to hand out pamphlets, and so forth and so forth. So they were there. Now, what happened in Indonesia, and what happens a lot in Nigeria, is that the Saudi ideas and the military power started to join hands. How did that go? The military then started to use the Islam card to try to suppress the people and try to get the people again to say, we want a military because they really protect us better. So how did this go? They would take those groups, pay them, and I cannot use another word, brainwash them. They would teach them certain parts from the Quran, taken from the Saudi Arabian pamphlets, and they would send them off, and the first places where they send them off were to the Spice Islands of the Moluccas. Have you heard of the Spice Islands?
Yeah.
Because they're nicely far away, They're an island, you cannot easily get there. They're quite remote, so it is not easy to quickly get there and get help. Plus, since the 16th century, the Spice Islands are half Muslim, half Christian. And they live mixed together. You know, one village is Muslim, one village is Christian, and some villages are mixed. And they have all kinds of local rituals to keep the peace between the two groups. And that has been going on since over 400 years. Okay? So the Spice Islands were a good target. Because what did they want? And I will quote now from this novel that I will send around. And it is very, very sad. This novel writes nothing that is not true, but it is written down beautifully in a novel. In one of the islands called Noli, tiny island, a group of seven jihadis comes to shore, just dressed as normal, regular men, and goes to the local ruler who, since more than 5 years, already has received money from Saudi Arabia and pamphlets to spread the word of Islam. But the guy doesn't realize who sent that money. But every month in his bank account is money deposited. So you see, there's a long-term planning going on. Every month in his bank account, he gets a sum of money, and then he gets cassettes and books and pamphlets, and he's supposed to spread the word of Islam on the island. He is the leader, he's actually a sultan. And what he has done is he set up a Quran study group. Because I love this example, that the study of the Quran was considered so hard that the local teacher of Arabic used stories from Thousand and One Night to teach Arabic. That was a more accessible language. Okay, can we follow me? So they come. The islanders see seven men come ashore and think, who are those kids? But they don't know who they are. They have no idea. They go to the sultan. He receives them in his palace. And there they remind him of the money he got since 5 years. Okay? Do we get the picture? Then they tell the sultan, thanks be to God, Islam is the foundation of our national identity. Nothing should pollute this. For too long, our leaders tolerated the Christian scum and gave them leadership positions. But see what they did. They stole from the people and secretly tried to divert us from the path of true faith. Then they say to the Sultan, we can help you, and we can help rid you of these Christians. Yes, it's time to liberate these islands, chimed in the companions. Freedom is purity of faith, shouted another from the rear. The Sultan says, people will surely die. He knew, though, there was no resisting these people with their crazed convictions and simple loyalty to Islam. Again, the surety, the simplicity, right? He also felt his own resistance crumbling. The leader looked him straight in the eyes and, using a mixture of poor Arabic and Javanese Indonesian, quoted a verse from the Quran. Think not of those who are slain in Allah's ways as dead. Nay, they live, finding their sustenance in the presence of their Lord. So what are they? Those are slain in Allah's way, they are? The martyrs, right? Here. Because he says, if I kill the Christians and I get killed, I'm a martyr, and where do I go? Paradise? What do I get in paradise?
Virgins.
Many virgins. Are the virgins in the Quran? Yes. In the Quran it says there are huris in paradise. Lately, you remember? There has been research, because this is a Syriac word, huris. And you know what it actually means?
Raisins.
Raisins. Right, a bowl of white raisins. Yeah. When you live in the Arabian desert, raisins are very attractive. They're a delicacy. Think about it. So why not raisins? So anyway, I just can't wait to go to heaven one day and see what Muhammad Atta is eating. Are doing with the raisin. Sitting disappointed in a corner, saying, "Oh, I don't know." Anyway, so this is, you see, this is, and then so they go then from the Sultan, they go to the mosque, yeah, and in the mosque they start to talk to the youngsters, to the young men who are a bit bored on that little island, right? And then they say things like, even if we have to rebuild from nothing, even if we lose our loved ones in the process of this struggle, we will build our own righteousness and the heroism we possess. Don't be afraid to die, the leader said. There was emotion in his voice. The blood of the wounded will smell like musk on the day of resurrection. Nothing will interfere with Allah's reward. We cannot allow the power in this country to fall into the hands of the Zionist agents or groups who hate Islam. Who are the enemies of Islam? Look around you, my brothers. See the Chinese Christians, their grasping ways that bring you into debt, and the Christians, how they force their religion on you. You hear their bells, their rough church songs. Don't they pollute the true faith? How often we find ourselves being asked to tolerate them, even join them? These are the enemy, and they must be crushed. So this is what he says in the mosque. And slowly from the back, young men get excited and say, and then a voice from the back cries, "Death to the Christians." So they have lived for hundreds of years together, never thought about it, but there comes this guy who speaks a little Arabic. Remember that I told you that Arabic is the holy language? You have the power when you know the Arabic. And there it starts. And what then happens, and this is factual, this happened in many of the islands. These guys were trained by the military as to how to murder someone really fast and cut up the body in the most gruesome ways. That they were, and decapitate it. In a matter of an hour, they move out and kill 56 Christians who are sitting, minding their own business in the morning, cleaning their fish in their houses. This, of course, creates huge anger. First of all the Christians who are left alive, they flee to one spot, and Christian youth joins, creates a militia and starts to kill Muslims. And then the army comes in. Then the army comes in, because this is what they needed. Now they are needed and have to make peace and just show the people that they are strong. And first thing the army, the commander says that, "Oh, these Christians are such a problem. Look what they did. They are so aggressive." And the whole issue is turned around. And that the Christians started this, and that this was a Christian issue, and see, we have to get rid of it. And then the army starts to prepare to evacuate all the Christians, not saying to where. And then the islanders secretly get together and decide to go back to their original rituals. And they make peace using their original rituals and leaders. And then they confront the army and say, "Look, we have made peace again. We don't need you." And then they were all lucky that in Jakarta, the headquarters changed their minds. That jihad in the Spice Islands attracted too much negative international news. That was not good for the PR. So they suddenly decided it had to stop. But you see how several things join together, and then the ultimate quest is power. And in the end, a whole community is more or less destroyed. A community that lived peacefully together. And from there, then they will try to, Islamize people or purify, get the Christians out, and so forth, and so forth. So you see, you have very many different models, and this, what I just told you, happens, for example, in Nigeria too. These engineered conflicts, I call it, these engineered conflicts. And people fall for it. You come and quote some Arabic, and they think you are a holy person, or you are a person of authority, because remember, we also talked about that, the problem is who can speak for Islam. And now everybody can, you see? And so it has become a huge power game that is going on. And at the same time, it's a huge issue within the Muslim world. It is moderate Muslims, progressive Muslims, as we said, that I think Mark, you asked that, right? They start to fight back. But there's one problem.
The surety is based on simplicity. Nothing is merely simple. Moderate and progressive Muslims, they think too complex. You know, they use philosophy, they use the history, they take their model stuff from sociology, economics, and so forth. And so you can't read them in one page and just take it in and say, okay, this is what I now believe. You see, you have to read their books and think about it. And that is the problem. That is the problem. As long, and maybe you recognize that when I talk about very far-right youth, right? The problem is that you then, no, you stay insular because these people, these modern people, also pollute you, and also they make you dizzy. You don't want to think too much. Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly the same problem with mainline Protestantism, trying to combat fundamental Protestantism.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it is, you know, as long as someone doesn't blow up the whole metro system, I mean, in a way, you can believe what you want as long as you do not impose it on others. That is the issue. And that is, we are still protected by our freedom of religion, because that is, of course, then the problem in a lot of Muslim countries. If you do not have freedom of religion, and they do gain the upper hand, then you're toast, like in Sudan, where they at one point, you know, enforced the Islamic law.
Congress can pass laws affecting religion, even though we supposedly have freedom.
Yeah, but I think, I'm not sure, maybe I'm too positive about America. I don't think they could really ever destroy the freedom of speech and religion. Do you think so?
No, in this country?
I don't. I think people would raise up. I don't think people would accept that here. I don't think so. They can try. But it can never be like Khomeini's Iran. No. It can never be. As I say, we are too individualistic, we're too critical, we're too this, too that. Headache for Bin Laden. I don't know who had. I know it's time, but yeah, it's fine with me if we take two more questions. Is that okay?
Except that even Christian rightists now are talking about the so-called separation of church and state and so forth. Question I have here, in terms of trying to get at the motivation of all these various groups, how much of a fact it seems to me that up to and including World War II, most of the Muslim world was under colonial domination and had been for some time. How much of the motivation of whatever country they're in is a kind of an anti-Western, anti-Christian rebellion against centuries of Western Christian domination?
A lot, but it's not the prime mover. The prime mover is really the idea Islam is in decay, and that is why Christians could take over. If we would have been better Muslims, this would not have happened. That is the prime issue. Mm-hmm. And so, and then what brought us into decay? Christians. The West. But what brought Muslims, because that's why you have to be careful not to say just Christians, what brought Muslims in India in decay? Hindus. See? So it depends on where you are, what the decay factor is. So it is really from inside. It's a reaction that we need, but then ultimately is we need to regain our power. We need to regain our dignity. Remember that that's what the leader spoke about in the novel, dignity. Oh, I should pass it around if you want to see it. Dignity. He talks about dignity. Sorry. And the things that are our right. So it's a very complex layer after layer, and it's slowly developed. And also, have you noticed that Bin Laden always has a new enemy and a new cause? I mean, he didn't care about Palestine a bit until it was pushed in a corner, and then suddenly Palestine came in his discourse. Have you noticed that? Bin Laden is changing his courses depending on, you know, where he thinks he can find support.
Just like Bush.
I feel I'm not at liberty to say anything because I'm still American, but I am from the Netherlands. I don't really get it yet. I mean, I'm from Europe. We are all just gazing at America, thinking,
what's happening? It's just...
Sorry.
you had a question?
Well, just a comment. I think it was in Diana Eck's book that she said that almost all the mosques built in the United States are funded by Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, yeah, almost all. And what is so sad, for example, in New Chicago, in... I forgot the area. Never mind. And it were Christians and Muslims together who started to build a mosque. Palestinian, Lebanese, Syrian, Christian and Muslims. They started to build a mosque because they needed something together and, you know, a community center. And then Saudis took over. Yeah. And it is the preachers are trained in Saudi Arabia. And they come, and as I say, the pamphlets are all the same. They're so boring. There is no philosophy. There is no literature. There is no mysticism. There is no questioning. It is so boring, you know? And it sounds the same whether you talk to someone in Tajikistan or in Chicago. It's the same. And that is what, to me, is, well, disturbing. And I guess if you go to very far-right Christianity, it's the same. You have that too, right? So there's lots of questions. You are very free to ask. And those of you who want to leave and get in line, go ahead. Yeah?
What I find Syrian alarming is that they were able, with a few bucks for 5 years, and seven people destabilize 400 years of COVID.
I know. Because
that's what's really scary.
It is, and see how well thought out it was, how well planned it was. But of course, then, because the opportunity...